Accession number 28709, Reel 5.
Okay, this is Bunty Lawson, Reel 5.
What I had never realised was that the Mediterranean could be as rough as it was between Alexandra and Taranto. We were in a tiny little flat-bottom boat that I think was more accustomed to going up and down the rivers in India. And I think we were in convoy. But it was an absolute hell trip. Fortunately, I'm a so-called good sailor. Poor Ruth, who was also sharing a cabin with me, is not. And I became terribly sadistic and kept telling her I'd had porridge for breakfast. And she went greener and greener. Anyway, eventually we arrived at Taranto. And we went in convoy, lorries again, up to Bari. All our equipment had gone round by sea to Bari, all our caravans we were going to work in, all our radio equipment. And the Germans had bombed Bari Harbour, and there was a tanker, petrol tanker, and an ammunition ship anchored side by side. And great was the bang there was, and everything had gone up in the harbour, including all our equipment. So we arrived there without any equipment to work on and no work to do. 205 group, which were a bomber group, took us in to feed us in their headquarters in the middle of Bari, and we were housed at the Imperiali Hotel, which was on the outskirts. No, it was right on the seafront of Bari. Most of the windows had blown in, so it was rather a draughty hotel at that time. There was nothing for us to do, and an air commodore, whose name I cannot remember, and I genuinely can't, who'd had his eye on Ruth, said would she care to accompany him? He was on a trip to MAF headquarters, I think, outside Naples, for a trip across the Apennines, as there wasn't any, we were just hanging about without any work. So she said yes. So she then flapped off to me and said, you've got to come as chaperone. So I said, oh, very well, I would quite like to have a trip across the Apennines, which was a splendid trip. It was one of snow the whole way. And we arrived in Foggia, where we were going to have lunch. I mean, the air commodore wasn't a bit pleased to see me, but he had to put up with it or not go on his trip. And we stopped at Foggia and had lunch at this American, I think they were known as American clubs. And there was a couple of American generals who were absolutely charming. We had a nice lunch. We found out where the loo was, because it was a very cold day. And we then had several drinks at lunchtime, piled back into the car, and I was given a great hug and gave a great hug back to this little American general. We got into the car, and I said to the air commodore, what a charming little general. Who was he? He said, that was just General Doolittle. Would you mind behaving yourself, more or less? Anyway, staff car dropped him off at MAF headquarters and took Ruth and myself off to Sorrento, where we had 48 hours, very pleasant, just wandering about in this, admittedly, winter sun, but it was pleasant enough, and it was a pretty little place, and did a bit of shopping. And then the staff car came and picked us up, and then he picked up the air commodore, and we went back to Bari again. To find that in the meantime, our equipment had arrived, so nobody was best pleased with us that we weren't there when we were most wanted. They weren't exactly surprised, but they weren't too pleased. And our trailers, all our caravans, which our wireless equipment was in, were parked in the playground of the village school. Village not really unlike Laycock, and the headmaster's house had been commandeered for us to live in, and we were quite busy, in fact very busy at work. It It wasn't the most comfortable place to work because we couldn't actually stand upright in the caravans, which was a snag. If you're always stooped, going to fetch more books or going to fetch another radio or something or other. But it was pleasant enough. Very cold, very wet. In fact, it was so cold that we were allowed to draw to wear trousers, which we weren't usually, and we were issued with, I think they were New Zealand Air Force trousers, which were much softer than the British khaki ones. They were a nice, very soft, woolly mixture. So we wore layers and layers of clothes, and then if we were going into Bari to be social, have dinner or dance or something, we then had to go back into our uniforms, very cold, but it was worth it just to try and look smart again. And we'd only been really working for, I shouldn't think more than, well, it was Christmas we had, and it was after Christmas we went to Sorrento, so I should think it was in about March when the orders came through that four of us who'd been doing Y work for over a year by that time were to report to MAF headquarters rear outside La Maza, outside Tunis. So we were flown off there. Actually, it was a fairly interesting trip because Vesuvius was still vaguely erupting. And I'd never seen an erupting volcano before. They'd had to evacuate hospitals and various things just down below Vesuvius. It was all quite exciting. And we got to La Maza, and we were doing perfectly ordinary, frightfully dull ciphers. But it was about March, I suppose, and it was when the edge of the desert blooms, and it was really the most fortunate time. We were only there for under 6 weeks to be there, because the anemones were about 4 inches in diameter, and huge violets. I've never seen anything like them before or since. And we had one trip off to the most gorgeous hill village called Sidi Bou Said, I think, that I've ever seen in my life. So I was very fortunate there that I did another bit of sightseeing in amongst rather dull ciphers. And then we were posted, though the rest of the Y-wing WAFs all arrived as well.
And this was about spring?
This is about spring, 1944. And there we were all posted to MAF Advanced, which was at Caserta in Italy. So I was much happier about that. We were going back to nearer where the war was. I didn't like being sidetracked back to North Africa. All the fun was over there. All the drama was over. And we did. By that time, I'd been promoted, not because I was particularly efficient, because I wasn't, but because I was so senior, they had to promote me. And Ruth was promoted as well. We both suddenly became flight officers, which made me feel a bit better. And there's not a lot to say, really, except that the original four that chaired the bungalow, we all married pilots or members of 205 bomber group who'd all been in the desert together, and all marriages lasted. Well, Anne's didn't last very long because Sammy died, but that wasn't because they fell out or anything. But apart from that, living there was not exactly comfortable either. They commandeered a stable block the side of the road that we lived in, which was, again, incredibly. We were always short of sleep because it was during the build-up at Cassino, Monte Cassino battle, and the tank transporters went past our bedroom windows. We were on the ground floor of the stables, being on the ground floor anyway, stupid remark, and they made a heck of a noise going up until after midnight, but they made worse noise coming back in the small hours of the morning empty, because they rattled from end to end. And then if you get your head on, we were sleeping on camp beds the whole time, You could get your head down and go to sleep in between tank transporters. You were lucky, because once you were asleep, on the whole, they didn't wake you up. It was just trying to get to sleep while they jogged up and down the road. I had various nice trips from there. After Rome had fallen in June, I was in Rome within 48 hours of it falling into our hands. A South African pilot flew me up there to have a look at it. And the town was wide open. I mean, I'd only got to go into a shop. Do you want nylons? Do you want perfume? Do you want this? It's absolutely incredible. And Anne and I went back a couple of months later, and the black market was ruling everything. It was a different town completely. But that first 48 hours, and I was obviously in uniform, otherwise I couldn't have flown up there. And in one shop, a chap said, turned to me and said, "And you were a pilot?" And I was just about to be honest and say, "No, of course I'm not." And my escort turned around and said, "I think she's flown as many hours as most people." And left it at that. So I didn't argue. Used to go to Sorrento often. Went to Ischia, which I preferred to Capri, on leave.
You said you were up in Florence as well.
Hmm?
You were in Florence as well.
I only... my original thing was it had taken me so long to get out to the Middle East by sea that I wanted to come back over land. But I was Torex. They didn't like leaving us overseas, girls, for much more than 2 years. And I was posted home shortly after Ian and I got engaged. And he said, "You got some leave due to you. There's an aircraft going up to Florence. Shall we go?" So I said, "Yes." I said, "Well, there's one more city I can tick off my list." And we had this really hair-raising flight up there, and I think it was an Anson again, in tipping rain. They were still fighting on the outskirts of Florence. And we landed, and going just round the taxi track, the pilot went off the taxi track and into the mud and got bogged down. So we had to be pulled out of that one. In the hotel we stayed in, I went down, we both went down to the bar for a drink before dinner, and one of the fighter wings was there, led by Duncan Smith, father of the short-time Prime Minister of England, with his wing. It was quite an amusing evening. The trip back, I have no recollection of at all. It must have been fine by that time. And then my posting home came through. And I don't know how I should have gone, presumably by sea, but I can't remember. But Dan said, "Do you want to fly back?" And I said, "Yes, of course." And he said, "Well, I'll get you on an aircraft somehow." So getting me on an aircraft somehow was getting me sent a second pilot on, I think it was the Dakota, back to England. So I was perfectly happy over this. So most of the passengers on board were army, and most of them going home on short visits just for a conference or something. So I had quite a lot of luggage. I'd been, let's face it, it was by just coming up to my second year away. I'd done 2 full years away. So I had two trunks, I think, by this time. Enough?
Okay.
On again?
No, it's okay. It's still running.
Hmm?
It's okay. It's still running.
It's still running. Right. So anyway, we took off. And we landed during the Mistral in the south of France to refuel there. And I'd never been out in the strength of that wind before. It was incredible. Anyway, the pilot, with his broken English, said, if you go to that hut over there, you'll get a sandwich and a cup of coffee, and then come back here, and we take off again. So I was battling my way against the wind over to this hut, and a jeep stopped and said, where are you going? So I said, that hut over there, to get a cup of coffee and a sandwich. So I climbed into the jeep, and then I couldn't see the rest of the crew in there, so I bolted my coffee and my sandwich, and I thought, dreadful, I must get back to this blinking aeroplane. So that was all right, because the wind was behind me. But there was a row of about, I don't know, six or eight Dakotas. And to me, one Dakota looks much like another. And I didn't know which I'd come out of, which was a slight embarrassment. So I opened various doors, and then just inside the door of one of them, I spied my luggage. So I climbed in. Nobody else was on board at all. So I went up to my second pilot seat. And then another officious chap came up and said he wanted the aircraft papers. So I scrabbled about, and I said, is this what you want? So he said, yes, that's exactly, and pinned them onto his board and said, this is a bit irregular. Second pilot, section officer Nash, is that you? So I said, yes. Well, he said, I'm going to inquire into this. So he disappeared off into the storm. With that, fortunately, all the other passengers came back, and the pilot, I said, look, would you mind taking off more quickly than you've ever taken off in your life before? And I told him, and he said, yes, because I think we'd both be for the high jump. So we took off into this howling mistral, and we got back to Leiden really rather late to a rather bad-tempered customs officer who'd been having to wait behind to check us through customs. And as I say, most people just had hand luggage and nothing else. When it got to be, he said, and how much luggage have you? And I said, well, that bedding roll, two trunks and five suitcases. So in sheer desperation, he put a chalk mark up on each one, let them through. And we then went off into the mess. And he said, what have you got in those trunks? So I said, well, can you do anything about it? He said, no, absolutely. I said, really and truly, nothing, I think, that you could have possibly. I've got a bolt of cloth to give my mother. I've got some Italian leather gloves for various members of the family and a few trinkets, and that really is all. So he said, oh, no, I wouldn't have stopped any of that. And then I was told, well, you could. I couldn't stay the night there, I don't think. And I said, well, I wanted to get at Reading Station to get the little local train to Sandhurst Halt. My parents, by the way, had no idea I was coming home. So they said, well, we take you into Swindon. Everybody else was going up to London. So I thought, well, I might as well go up to London. I may as well go up to London, sit in the train all night. As anything else, and it's easy to get down from London to Camberley. So the train stopped at Reading. So I said, oh, I might get a local train from here. Get out, get out. So they threw me out. The guard had my luggage. He threw that out. And I told him my life's history in three small gasps. If you see. He said, get over the line. No, you get under the underground, you know, the steps underneath, down to the southern line. And I'll get your luggage over there in time for you. So I stumbled down there, up the other side, got into the train. I saw my luggage was being thrown into the guard's van. And we chugged off down. We eventually stopped at Sandhurst Halt. So the guard said, well, this was after midnight by this time. There's nobody on duty here at night. You can't leave all this luggage here on an unguarded station. So I said, well, what am I to do? I can't carry it up the hill. My parents live at the top of that hill. So he said, I'll take it down the line. It's all got your name and address on it, hasn't it? And I said, yes. He said, I'll take it down the line and I will unload it at the first station I come to, which I think is Blackwater, which will have a guard on it all night. So I said, fine. So I left it to him. I got out of the train. I walked up the hill to my home, And my parents always slept with the bottom window wide open in their bedroom. And I thought, as usual, the scene is just as I left it. I arrived at the porch. I rang the night bell because, I say, my father was a doctor. So he had a day bell and a night bell. And there was a pause, and I heard my mother's voice said, "That's Bunty." And she said I'd heard my father had been called out on a night call and had only just got back. So they were both awake. And she said, "I'm certain that's Bunty's footsteps coming up the hill." So it was. So she said, "Where's your luggage?" I said, "I haven't the slightest idea." She said, "You've arrived back after over 2 years away. With Nylon, I had a little blue haversack thing with my, I think, a change of undies and my toothbrush in it." I said, "Yeah, sorry, the rest's all gone off down the southern line somewhere." So obviously we had a chat and one thing and another, and then thankfully I rolled into my own bed. And the next thing I knew was my mama standing there with a cup of tea for me to drink. And she said, "Darling, your luggage is piled up in the backyard." To this day, I have no idea who or what brought my luggage. And there were two trunks, five suitcases, all lying stacked one on top of the other in the backyard. Wasn't it absolutely incredible? Absolutely amazing.
How long did you actually get to stay at home? How long?
I think a fortnight. I'm not sure. I can't actually remember. And then I was posted to Air Ministry Whitehall, which nearly broke my heart, because I'd always been on a sort of active fighter station at home. Anyway, there was nothing I could do about it. And I didn't know where on earth I was going to live. So they had a WAF mess out at Avenue Road, very smart address, in St. John's Wood. And so I reported to the mess out there, and I was allocated a bed in, strangely late, Anne's, same room as Anne Smith. She got there before me. She came home before me. So we had this great big room. I've never lived in a mess which was nothing but females before. And the one had beautiful houses. The main one was where we ate. And I went over there the evening to get my usual evening drink before dinner and sat down in a nice, comfortable-looking armchair. And somebody said, "You can't sit there, the senior WAF chair." And I said, "Well, in which case, I will get up when the senior WAF arrives and let her have it. In the meantime, I am sitting here." And I decided there and then I wasn't going to live amongst a lot of women who were living like a lot of men in their club. I disliked it. So Anne and I put in for permission to live out. And we hadn't really got around to flat hunting or anything. And we were given permission to live out. So we said, "Look, we've nowhere to go." Panic set in immediately. The only thing I didn't like about St. John's Wood, which was the time of the buzz bombs, and we were terribly near Regent's Park. Well, I don't think I'd have minded a lion or something escaping from the zoo, but creepy crawlies in the way of a tarantula scared the living daylights out of me. I was petrified of creepy crawlies. I mean, a lion's big enough to avoid, but a tarantula, no. Anyway, we were fortunate. None of them did escape. And the buzz bombs didn't, as far as I know, never did hit Regent's Park Zoo. So we said, "Look, we've nowhere to go. Can we postpone our living out thing?" They said, "No, you'll go to the bottom of the list again if you do that." So we said, "Right, we'll go. We'll go." So we went. And we booked in, because it was the only place we could find to book, at the Regent's Park Hotel, which was jam-packed full of Americans. And honestly, I think they were crazy. They were far worse than tarantulas. You couldn't get out of a lift, but they swarmed on you. Anne was by this time engaged to a chap called Sammy Salmon. And we had to keep phoning up Sammy. "Sammy, come and take us out to dinner. We can't stay here." Anyway, Sammy was our saviour because he knew a quite senior civil servant who was living in a biggish flat, a family flat, with his family in Drayton Gardens. And because of the buzz bombs, his wife had one child at home and one child at school, day school, and she was in a perpetual flap that one was going to be bombed when, you know, she wasn't going to be there. So he said, I've got to get her out of London. She's getting into a state. I think he was too, actually. Offered us the flat, providing they could block off, I think, the dining room. I'm not sure, anyway, never used it. And their bedroom, and leave their clothes and everything there. So we had this rather grand mansion flat for a peppercorn rent in Drayton Gardens, which can't be bad. And I was terribly ashamed of the fact that I could find my way around Cairo and Naples and to a certain degree Alexandra and to a slight degree Beirut, but I didn't know my own capital. So during the shift that I came off at 3 PM, map in hand, I walked and walked and walked until I knew what people were talking about. Ian and I were married by this time. Oh, Anne then got married. And the senior civil servant wanted his flat back. And I managed to get the sublet of a flat, a bed sitting room in Chelsea Cloisters. And I stayed there till the end of the war. I had VE Day in London. And by that time, Ian and I never seemed to be off duty at the same time. So I then put in for an early discharge, and they were very fair. It was first in, first out. So I didn't have to wait very long for my discharge. And my discharge at the WAF came through on VJ Day, which I thought was very nice and neat. So I did exactly 39 till 45.